I appreciate everyone and your willingness to support our young folks at our LTC convention last weekend. We had a wonderful, wonderful time. The kids were representative of the congregation here. You can be proud. And I hope that if you see them running around in the hallway, you'll let them know how proud of them you are. They are a good group of young people. And they have great parents and good families, and we're thankful for your support. Thank you for praying for us, and thank you for encouraging us. It is a wonderful weekend. It's also an exhausting weekend for the kids and for the people who are there all week, but we've recovered, I think. So if you have time and you want to, stick around Sunday night so we can give them their rewards, let them know that we appreciate their hard work, and hope you'll stick around to do that if you can, right after our evening services. You might also know, and if you don't, we're going to take a large crew of them to Elfindale Manor Sunday, so we're going to stick around after morning services, and the puppets and drama teams are going to do their performances there for the residents, and the rest of us, Utes and whoever else want to hop in and come along, we're going to do some singing with them and just spend some time with the folks sitting there and enjoying company. So we're putting our LTC talents to good use, and we're going to do the same this summer when we head to West Virginia, back to my homeland, to a little bit to work with the congregation there. So we'll take some of those same things. So it's not for naught, I should say. It's for the productivity and hopefully for the growth of the kingdom and helpful for our congregation here. So thank you for your support. Since I haven't had a lot of time to say that, a few of you now, you can get it. So Luke chapter 24 is where we're going to spend the most of our time, but I want to start, even though I told you to turn there, I want to start in the book of Hebrews tonight and do some reading there first before we get into the actual, to our daily Bible reading from the book of Luke. Hebrews chapter 1, that's where I want to start. I'm reading from the New King James Version tonight, though I've been using the ESV here and there. I'm going to stick with this one tonight, if you don't mind. The book of Hebrews, we're going to start in chapter 1. Let's just read a few passages quickly. The first verse, some of the most magnificent, beautiful, excellent places to start and places to read. Hebrews chapter 1, let's start reading together, verse 1. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in times past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds, who, being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become so much better than the angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. Beginning his letter with a declaration of the excellencies and the glory and the deity of the Son of God, having become so much better than the angels. It's one understanding and one way that we have to understand the Son of God and the identity of who this Jesus is, and understanding who he is. To go over to chapter 2, start in verse let's just start in verse 8. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 8. On the opposite side of the spectrum, understanding Jesus as being this excellent, glory, and powerful God in the flesh, we also have this one in which we're told, citing from the book of Psalms, who put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under his feet, he left nothing that is not put under his feet. But now we do not yet see all things put under him, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, rather than in the beginning greater than the angels, now who was made a little lower than the angels, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone, because it was fitting for him. for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in the bringing of many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one, for which reason he is not ashamed to call us brethren. Skip down to verse 14. Inasmuch then, as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself, Jesus himself, likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who through the fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For indeed, he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brothers, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself has suffered, being tempted, he is able to aid those who themselves are tempted. That's a long reading. Beautiful, beautiful way to begin. As you read chapter 1 of the book of Hebrews, declaring that this Jesus of Nazareth is one who is not just Jesus of Nazareth, but this one is the Son of God. He is the express image of the person of God. He is the one who is so much greater than the angels. And in the very next chapter, makes really the argument for the exact opposite of that, that not only is he so much greater than the angels, actually he's made lower than the angels. And that he is very much so Jesus, son of Joseph of Nazareth, one and the same time. That's beyond what you and I probably are able to understand or comprehend or know the complexities of. It's difficult for us to wrap our head around those kinds of things. However, it is really, really important for us to remember that Jesus is both of those things. And that when we talk about Jesus of Nazareth, to exalt him as deity and forget the things that we read in chapter 2 is a gross misunderstanding of the identity of Jesus Christ. And to understand him in full, to understand him as the person that he is really what Christianity is about. It's about the relationship with this man, Jesus Christ, who is also one and the same time God in the flesh. To understand him in his fullest nature, to see him in this way, is what makes us be able to understand and really be able to ascend to the relationship with God that we've been asked to have or that we've been privileged to have. So to look at Jesus from both the standpoint of being divinity, while at the same time the standpoint of being a human being. Tonight, what I want to do is try to do our best to understand Jesus as a human being. And we've done so through our readings. We're going to read a few of our readings from this week, from Luke chapters 22 and 23 and 24, to stop and to pick out a few of these places in these readings where it helps us, to pick a few of these instances where the humanity of Jesus is evident, maybe in a subtle way where it's not quite as evident in other places, but to be unique enough that maybe we'll be able to grasp a little bit of this and give us something to think about. When you think about, at least for me, growing up and maturing and trying to get on my own spiritual footing, it's difficult for me, and I think for many people, to bring those two images of Jesus, Son of God, all-powerful being, while at the same time to be a human being, and try to bring those two things together was difficult for me and challenging for me. I remember when it's been many, many years ago now, but when the movie, The Passion of the Christ, came out, many people saw it, and of course, you know, it was, for what it's worth, it was an interesting movie to watch. One of the things that I think the movie did well was to emphasize and to take, and the director did enough effort and through his imagination, is to put scenes that were made up scenes, that were just fictional scenes, but in the imagination of the writer, to put this character, this actor, Jesus, in situations that were mundane and that were everyday things, like scenes in a carpentry shop, actually building and making tables, which we forget. We call him Jesus the carpenter, but you forget that that was his job every day for 30 years. He had a job. He had to do things. He had to make tables. There were scenes where you saw him sort of joking around with his mother, and being a personable person and not just the figure who stands in front of the crowds and delivers speeches as we see in sometimes the animated things or in the flannel graphs that we used to have when we were kids, you know, always Jesus standing in front and delivering lectures. But you see him as a person, and you see him as the guy who built things because he was Joseph's son, and the guy who had a mother and loved his mother and did what children and mothers do and goof around, and he was a child and grew up and had friends and played in the street and all those kind of things that are sometimes maybe hard for us to grasp. I remember when if you read in the scriptures, there are places where that sort of remind us of that. For example, when Jesus begins his ministry and he goes back to Nazareth, and he stands in the temple or stands in the synagogue and he reads, and the people begin to ask, where did he get these things? Isn't this Joseph's son? Because they don't know him as Jesus, Son of God. They know him as the kid down the street. That's Joseph's kid. We know, don't we know his brothers? Don't we know his sisters? Isn't his mother Mary? Isn't his father Joseph? Where is he getting these things that he's teaching us today? And you're reminded that this is exactly what he was, that he was a person. He was an everyday person. I read once in a writer in talking from in a study of the book of John, one of the things, and he posed the question, that, and everybody gives the answers pretty similarly, but John chapter 2 is the great story of Jesus going to the wedding at the Cana of Galilee, and he goes to the wedding, and it was the place where he turns the water to wine and all of these different things, and he poses the question in the writing, why do you think Jesus went to the wedding at Cana of Galilee? Do you want to guess? That's exactly what it is, right? We sometimes are tempted to say, well, he had to, it wasn't his time yet, but he went to perform this miracle, or he went to teach a lesson. But if you read John chapter 2, there's no lesson. There's nothing that comes along except for this short conversation with his mother. His mother's the one who tells him to perform the miracle. He went to the wedding because he was invited to the wedding, because he was a fellow who lived and knew the family. And the family invited Jesus to come to their wedding because he was a family friend or acquaintance of some sort. When you think about those kind of things, it brings Jesus down to the level that God meant for him to be at with you and me in the same kinds of things that you and I understand and go through. Tonight, what I want to do is I want to take some of our readings, Luke 22 to 24, and because we spent last Sunday and Bill did a great job in the study of the book of Romans, meditating on the resurrection, and because we've spent some time in some of these passages, in the appearances and the teachings of Jesus after the resurrection, I wanted to do something a little bit unique in trying to study these passages because we've talked about them recently. And so I pulled out a few of these that will remind us, that maybe are good reminders of the fact that Jesus was and is Jesus, Son of God, the man, Jesus Christ, right? That he is just like you and us. Let's look in Luke chapter 22. Let's start first. Luke chapter 22. Let me get there myself. Luke 22. This, of course, comes after we're told there's this plot to kill Jesus, and we're told that he has instructed his disciples to go into the city and prepare the Passover, meet the fellow there, go to the fellow's house and go up and prepare the meal, and everything will get ready. And then in verse 14, we're told, Luke 22, let's start in verse 14. When the hour had come, he sat down, and the 12 apostles were with him. And he said to them, with fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And then we could continue reading, and this is, of course, the place in which Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper and begins to talk about the bread and the cup and those kind of things of which we're familiar. The passage that stands out to me is chapter 22 and verse 15, and where the simple statement is made, with fervent desire, I've desired to come and to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. What's happening this night? Where are we at in the story of Jesus? I'm sorry? He's in the upper room in Jerusalem. He's there. He's going to institute the Lord's Supper. What happens later this evening? The betrayal, and then the next morning, the crucifixion, right? This is at the end of Jesus' life. What kind of mental state is a person in often if you're going to be, if you know that tomorrow is your morning? Sweat and bullets, right? And we'll find out later that's more true than maybe we realize, right? When he gets to the garden. There are probably, and maybe we could surmise, that there are different reasons that maybe Jesus would have said, I've really wanted to come and have this meal. I've with fervent desire, I've wanted to have this Passover with you. And some of them are reasonable, I'm sure. This is the place where he institutes the Lord's Supper, something that will be part of the Christian life from here until he comes again. Certainly important, and maybe that's a reason that he says, I want to be with you here. There are lots of teachings that go on during this, time. Luke doesn't record very many, just this instance of instituting the Lord's Supper and some of the conversations with the disciples. If you remember from the book of John, starting with about chapter 13, when Jesus washes the disciples' feet, all the way through, possibly up through John chapter 17, although there's some differences of when some of those things took place, whether it was after they left the room or whether they were still in the room. There's a lot that goes on during this meal. A lot of things. All of the teachings that they give to the apostles about the Spirit that will come. John chapter 14, about the many mansions he will go to prepare. John chapter 17 is the great prayer for himself and for his disciples and for all of the believers. All of those things that happen during this meal. So there is surely, and maybe that gives greater evidence to me, of the fact that the reason why he's able to say, I have really, really looked forward to having this with you. It's because he knows it's his last night. He's got a lot to give his friends, and he wants to share a nice meal with his friends before things are over. It's a great sign of humanity to me. And reading it is a great way to stop and to be able to say, and really, what's more human than simply wanting to be with your closest friends during the most difficult time in your life? Because certainly this is it, right? Certainly this is it, where literally the weight of the world is going to be on his shoulders, where the weight of the sin of the world is something he's going to have to do in a moment of grief when things could be overwhelming. We want our closest people nearby, don't we? Don't we want to be able to share these things when the fear is paralyzing, as we'll find out when we get to the garden, when he's overcome with emotion and with fear and with maybe anxiety or with doubt or whatever else it might be. Jesus said, I have longed with great desire to be able to eat this meal with you. And then we can read all that goes into this meal and everything that happens during this time. He just wants to sit down and be with his friends. What's more human than that? Again, as we've said last week, I just roll. And so if at any point something strikes you at which you want to contribute to this, please raise your hand and stop me and say what you wish to say. This is a class. I know it's difficult because of the bigger room, but would love to be able to have that part of it if you wish. Luke chapter 22, go over to verse 23. I'm sorry, no, verse 33, not 23. I didn't put it up on the screen. Sorry about that. Let's start in verse 31. So this is after he institutes the Lord's Supper. This is after the disciples have their argument about which one is greater and who gets to sit where and who gets to have what place in the kingdom. And Jesus sort of rebukes that situation. And this is the scenario when Jesus begins to talk directly to Peter and tells him about his own denial. Start in verse 31 with me. And the Lord had said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you've returned to me, strengthen your brethren. And he said to him, Lord, I'm ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster shall not crow this day before you will deny me three times, deny three times that you know me. This one may be for some a little bit surprising to come across, and it is a little bit to me because it's not language that you hear Jesus use very often in such a personal way like this. You hear Jesus oftentimes taking action in healings or, you know, stretch forth your hand or stand up and walk or I will take care of it or to go in and handle things. But you don't hear Jesus say things like this very often, which to me stands out as something, and maybe it's interesting and it's one that we sort of have to wrap our head around, the fact that the thought that the Son of God, you know, God in the flesh, who is deity himself, takes time to petition the God the Father on behalf of somebody else. It's not something that's not language that you hear very often. And it may be, maybe it's a little confusing or jarring when you read it first, but it's striking to me when you boil it down to what it is. It's a very personal encounter between Jesus and his friend Peter, where he says, I've prayed for you, Peter. You're going to do this. I know this. You're going to deny me. But I have prayed that God will, or that your faith will not fail. I've prayed for you. Be something to have the Son of God say, I'm talking to God for you. I'm petitioning God for you. I am praying for you. You think about the times that, and when I say that this language is not all that common, it doesn't mean that prayer in the life of Jesus is not common, because you see that oftentimes in the gospel writings. Mark chapter 1 is one of my favorite places where in Mark chapter 1 we're told that, and it's one of these great and busy days for Jesus. Mark is the gospel of action and of energy and things that are going on. And Jesus is one to begin his day in the synagogue. And if you remember, while he's preaching in the synagogue, that's when the demon-possessed man stands up and causes a scene. And Jesus heals the demon-possessed man. And then they leave the synagogue and they end up at Peter's mother-in-law's house. And he heals Peter's mother-in-law. And as he heals Peter's mother-in-law, the sick and more people come to him. And so they take Jesus out. And he spends all day, and we're told, well into the evening, after the sun had set, we're told, people are bringing their sick and their diseased and their demon-possessed to Jesus. And so Jesus begins his morning preaching and healing and teaching and preaching and healing, and all of these people well into the night. Jesus is doing all of these wonderful things. And then Mark tells us the next morning, a long while before daylight, Jesus gets up before everybody else and goes out to a solitary place by himself to what? To pray. It tells you how much he depended on it. Even as the person who is deity himself, it tells you that as a human being, Jesus is somebody who depended on it. In any morning you could pick where you could say, let's let Jesus sleep in this morning. He had a really long day yesterday. Maybe he needs his rest. He chooses to get up before everybody, a long while before daylight, which means the hours of rest were not many for Jesus. And he goes out by himself a long while before daylight to pray, we're told. It tells you how much Jesus as the person depended on his relationship with God and being able to pray. Then you, yeah, go ahead, David. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It says, Jesus answered, I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you know me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Jesus knows what's going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you think that Jesus kind of fluctuates back and forth between his humanity and his divinity? You know, because we have that other story over here in Mark chapter 4 where the storm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He's tired, he's asleep. But then, you know, he comes, you know, out of the stern and quiets the storm.
There's certainly a sense, and there's a lot of the word that comes to mind and explains it maybe is the word tension, where there is this obvious sort of pulling against one another, and for us to be able to to do something and divide those two is probably not possible. But you're right in the sense that there are times in which it's really clear that you can see Jesus' humanity and you can see him as a human being. And then there are other times when you can see him stand up in the boat and stop the storm, in which it's very evident. To me, the word tension maybe describes it better than any. And being able to, maybe differentiate between the two is not always as easy. I would tend to look at verse 34 as being able to say, he understands what Peter is going to be. He knows what he's going to do. His prayer is that his faith won't fail. Right? I know you're going to deny me, but I'm praying that it won't end you. Right? That there's something that there's hope and that there's mercy involved in it. But the same concept is true. And you can say maybe fluctuating back and forth, and when we get to the garden, it's maybe most evident. Right? Even in his very words that he's speaking, the tension between his all-powerfulness, right, versus his humanity and the powerlessness sometimes that people have, and trying to define those two, maybe, if that makes any sense in my mind. There are places where Jesus, in John chapter 17 is the prayer that we mentioned a minute ago. John chapter 17 is the place where Jesus, in this place, maybe is another one of those places where it is so profound and so large in the things that he asked for God, but yet in the same way are so tender and so personal and so individual and so human, in which he depends on God to say, I'm praying for all of the believers, but then he also stops and he prays for himself that I can have strength, you know, through what's coming, and then stops and also says, but I'm praying for these men so that you will keep them from the evil one. And it's just evident of how much he depends on us. And this is sort of, we have this occurrence here where he stops in a much more personal and really kind of mundane way, in the ways that you and I would do for a friend who's going through a lot, to say, I'll be praying for you this week. And that's essentially what the message is to Peter. I know you've got something that's coming. Yes, I'm the Lord, and I know you're going to fail, but I've got you in my prayers. Something you and I would do, and we do on a regular basis every day, and it helps me to see Jesus in that way. Who knows? As a friend is concerned with the well-being of another, Jesus is worried about his friend. Simply wants him to be strong and wants the Lord to strengthen him when his faith is weak. And so another place where Jesus' humanity is shown. Let's go over to another one. This is the place, maybe the one that is most most evident, and the place in which it is most clear. David Roper has written a commentary on the life of Christ in the Gospels, and he cites this fellow whose name I'm not familiar with. His name is D.W. Cleverly Ford. I don't know anything about it. His quote is rather familiar to a lot of people. You find it all over the place, but I took this one from David Roper. Mr. Ford says this: I doubt if I am the man to preach the sermon. I doubt if I possess the verbal skills, the spiritual sensitivity, or the theological insight to portray the most moving scene in all of the gospel record. What can I do? It's here and nowhere else that we come closer to the man, Jesus. If I leave out Gethsemane, I fail to show Jesus as he truly was. In Luke 22, starting in verse 39. Let's just read the short record that Luke gives us. Coming out, verse 39, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and he prayed, and he said, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. When he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. And he said to them, why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. And then we'll continue reading as we go. I think Mr. Ford is right that this may be, more than any other place, is where it's most clearly evident of the fact that Jesus is the Son of God, and yet at the same time Jesus is Jesus, son of Joseph of Nazareth, to help him really see the difficulty that Jesus has to deal with. There are a few things in this passage that to me help remind us of this. In verse 39, very simply, we're told he went out to the Mount of Olives just like he was accustomed of doing, right? He had habits. He had places where he felt most comfortable, he had places where he liked to go, places where there was convenience or ease or comfort. We're told the Mount of Olives was that place. It was a place he and his disciples liked to hang out. I don't know what it was that made it that. Maybe it was just the convenience to the city. Maybe it was the serenity of a garden, or maybe it was shady and cooler there than other places. Whatever it was, that's where he was accustomed to going, just like you and I would like to have our own place where we are familiar and comfortable and like to spend time with our people. But in a deeper way than that, we have those places where Jesus goes into the garden and he goes off to pray. And the other accounts give us different sort of, give us things to add to what was happening. In Matthew 26, we're told that he went to the disciples and said, "Pray that you don't enter into temptation, because the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." It's a quote that we're often familiar with and that we even sing in some of our songs. This was a warning, I think, to the disciples in the way that Jesus uses it, right? I'm going to go off and to pray. You all stay here and pray that you don't enter into temptation. The spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. But it's also a very true statement of the situation that Jesus finds himself in, because he goes off into to begin to pray, and he's overcome with anguish, and he's overcome with sorrow, and he falls, and the other accounts we're told he falls flat on his face, and he begins to pour out his heart in sorrow and in deep agony. And he says these amazing words, right? "If it is your will, take this cup away from me." Now, if you boil that down to what you and I would ask, what's he asking? In your own words, what's that? "I'd sure like to not do it this way," right? If there's another way to do this, that would certainly be nice, maybe, right? Have you ever... Yeah, Bill, go ahead. Yes, sir. Well, that would make two of us. Mm-hmm. Well, we're told that he knew all men and that he knew the hearts of men, but to be able to put an amount on that is, you'll have to ask him when you get there, maybe, right?
Did he know when he was going to die that he would sit at the right hand of God?
I would tend to believe so. The Gospels would seem to indicate that. If he knew that he was going to be glorified and he knew that what was coming up, and John chapter 17 would give us some indication of what he was looking forward to, I would say. You would think, in one sense, and in the other sense, in the sense that you and I would be afraid of, right? That in a few hours we're going to have to suffer beyond the ability of what we can ever imagine. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Being the Son of God at the same time, he would be more sensitive to what it would mean, what the suffering he was going to go through would mean, what the cup of judgment against sin would mean, what the paying of the price. As a man dreads this, but it's not, he doesn't have less bravery about him than other men who've been three times in Luke what's going to happen. So he knows that. And that makes the humanness of it even more touching.
It does. To know everything that's coming and still be able to. And that's the second phrase of all of this, right, of his statement. It would certainly be from the human side it would be, if there's another way to do this, that would be great. And then on the other side, to be able to say, but I know what needs to be done. It's not what I really want. It's not about what I want. It's your will that needs to take precedence. And so you are able to see the tension between those two things, from a man who is sorrowful and and in the accounts, you know, fearful and anxious and upset about what he has to endure, while at the same time going through with it because he knows what it amounts to. He knows what his situation is going to accomplish, and he knows what this kind of suffering is going to be able to do for people and for you and for me. And so maybe thanks be to God for that second phrase, right? That it's not what I want, it's what you want.
He knew Isaiah 53.
He did.
He had read Isaiah 53.
That's right. He knows what he's enduring, yes.
Dennis. I think this can all be summed up in where we started earlier, in those three words, before I suffer.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Everything signifies the humanity of Christ. He knew he was going to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can see why he was praying, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me.
Let's try.
You wrote in something about a movie. Let me bring in a movie.
Go ahead.
I'll try to match it up.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
They knew the great possibility of what was going to happen. Could it be that when the Lord said, before I suffer and for this prayer, there is the man who knew what was ahead of him?
Mm-hmm.
We want to get as close to God as we possibly can the closer we get to the end.
Absolutely. Closer to the end. To be. It never, you're never ready for it, are you?
Close to the end.
That's right. There are, which is a reminder that we're halfway through, right? So there are several other places, things that we could mention. I've put up here the place in which Judas comes to betray Jesus, and Jesus has to look him in the eyes and say, are you betraying me with a kiss, Judas? To look your friend in the eye, to know the man that you've spent all of this effort and time, and have to say, are you doing this to me? Are you really doing this to me? A human, sort of the human side of this. There are, of course, these specific things that maybe are easily overlooked and not thought about, but the fact that Jesus, as in the human form, his body ceased to live, and somebody had to take that body down off of the cross and essentially do the funerary practices for what a body is, to have to take it down from the cross and clean it up and wrap his body in linens and then bury it. What else is more human than having to go through the things that happen at the end of a life? And then, of course, at the end of here, the one that we studied on Sunday, which was the breakfast by the sea, where there are two of these situations. Luke 24 records a situation where he shows up in the room and he says things like, I'm not a spirit. Does a spirit have flesh and bones like I do? And then says maybe the most human thing of all, do you have something to eat? We have anything to eat here? And Jesus has to sit down and they cook him a meal. And then as we studied Sunday in the breakfast by the sea passage, where Jesus becomes a great host and sits down with his friends and says, and of course performs the miracle of allowing them to catch all of these fish, and then says, come and sit with me. And he cooks them breakfast before he leaves earth. What more human is there than to simply spend your last morning on earth with your friends, to sit down and have breakfast, and to be the gracious host that he is? There are lots of things that we could do, and I had planned at the end of this to simply, you know, pose the question of why this matters. What is the significance of taking the time to look at these things to remind us of that? And there are a few of them that you can maybe meditate on yourself. I've given just a couple here that we appreciate the sacrifice of leaving and understanding what he endured and what he had to go through, especially when you keep it in the context of Hebrews chapter 1 and you realize the excellencies of his glory and the express image of his person, and we sing out of the ivory towers and into a world of woe. And when you stop and you consider the mundane things that he had to endure in light of where he was before all of this, it helps maybe to appreciate the sacrifice of what he left and understanding what he came. I think we can take some time to appreciate the humility of learning. If you read in the book of Hebrews later, and we were going to go back and read these, in chapter 2 we're told that he, in dealing with his suffering and understanding what he had to endure, understanding that we don't have a high priest who can't sympathize with our weaknesses, but with, in every point, just like we are, was tempted, and yet without sin, to go through the things that we had to go, and to learn how to endure life. And we're told in the next chapter, chapter 5, that he had to learn obedience by the things that he suffers. The appreciation of the fact that he came as a baby and had to learn how to be an obedient child of God, and how to learn to be like you and I and follow a will and learn to be someone who essentially follows the law and follows the rules and knows how to keep those things. It maybe helps us appreciate it more when we see it that way. And then maybe appreciate the blessedness of what it is to serve. Earlier in the same chapter, when he's in the situation where he's rebuking the disciples for their wish to be great in the kingdom, is the place where he tells the story about what happens when you consider the relationship of one who is a servant and one who sits at the table. And he says the person who sits at the table in regular everyday life is the one who is greater, because he's probably the one who owns, or the one who is the wealthy person, or the landowner, whatever it is. Jesus says he is the one who is the greatest in the scenario. I'm not in the place of the person who sits at the table. I have come to be the one who serves. And it helps us to appreciate, when you consider his highness of what he was, to where he places himself on the totem pole, if you will, to lower himself to the extent in which he should have been the one sitting at the table being served. But the blessedness of being able to say, but that's not where I'm going to be. I have taken the place as the one who serves. I'm the one who's come here to do these kinds of things. And gives us the example of what it means to be the kind of person that Jesus was and wishes all of us to be. Thank you for your comments tonight. Appreciate it. Of course, we moved slower than what we intended, as always, but hope it'll give you something for you to think about. Continue in your Bible reading. If you don't have one, the third quarter sheets are on the table. Pick one up. Start tomorrow, the first. The next day is the first, so a couple days from now, we'll get into the third quarter. So let's pray, and then we'll be dismissed. God, we